You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 233, MPs voted on airstrikes over Syria, but should they listen to their constituents, the party whip, or their conscience? Hooray, Britain has a new world boxing champion in cuddly little Tyson Fury. Wait a minute, what did he say to the Daily Mail? And Spotify has released its year in review, and it's a world away from the top 40. Imagine, it's all coming up after Pulp and Everybody's Problem.
One of 13 singles they released before they even got near the top 40, and indeed try finding a record company that would offer that level of confidence and support in 2015. From 1983, Pulp and Everybody's Problem. Welcome to podcast 233. I'm Terence Stackham, and she's nobody's problem. She's everyone's solution.
That is too kind. Oh, far too kind. God,
it's Juliet Harris.
Hello.
Hello. Jules, I'm told we live in a democracy. We all have a free vote to elect a woman or a man to represent us at the country's governing body at Westminster.
Indeed, I like the fact that you've put woman first there. I'm very enthused by that. Thank you.
Yeah, nice touch. Mm. But I often think that the democracy often stops at that point, because rather than exercising their vote as an exemplar of that democracy, our MPs immediately become pulled in. They're pulled in at least three directions, with a possible fourth direction for those who sign up for outside directorships or allow themselves to be influenced by lobbyists. Mm. And this dilemma was never more clearly demonstrated than on Wednesday of this week, when MPs debated the concept of airstrikes over Syria. Each MP then faced a decision. Should they vote according to the party whip, a consensus of their constituents, their conscience, or in some cases, external factors depending on their outside interests? Well, which of these voices should they listen to, Jules?
Well, there's an awful lot going on, isn't there? I suppose in terms of really most of the chat has been about Labour MPs and this vote particularly. My view is that, I mean, it is awkward, isn't it? Because when you go to the ballot box, you are voting for a candidate put up by a political party. So by voting for a particular candidate, you are putting your vote against that political party. But what you're also doing is you're voting for that candidate as an individual to represent your interests at Westminster. So basically, all of those things are going on. You're voting for which party you think will run the country the best. You're voting for which person will make the decisions that they make in a way that will best represent you as a constituent. So yes, it is an incredibly finely balanced system, which has become very finely unbalanced this week, I think. My view in terms of whether or not people should be bounced into supporting things by party members. So there's been an awful lot of momentum based things in the Labour Party saying, oh, you know, you should vote with the party. And if you don't like it, you should just go and join the Tories, which, you know, if ever there was a phrase I am bored of hearing or bored with hearing. Sorry, Mum, she gets cross when I say bored of hearing, bored with hearing. It is that. My view, somewhat old-fashioned, is that you elect an MP as a constituent to represent your interests. So my view is that my MP, I didn't vote for our MP, I voted someone else, but my MP has been elected to represent the constituents. So this is where it, you know, I think people get frustrated that I didn't vote for my MP, but she still represents me because a majority of people voted for her, because that, like it or not, is how democracy works. So I think MPs are responsible for, you know, listening to the views of their constituents, because put it this way, my MP is a Conservative, I'm not a Conservative, but if in voting on behalf of the constituency of Hastings and Rye, my MP only listened to members of her political party and did not listen to any of her constituents, I'd be pretty annoyed about that. So I don't think many people on the team that is still allegedly my team have really given that any thought. So I would give that a point. You're electing an MP to do the best job that they can. So I think to some extent, when you've got a decision about war, I think it's entirely reasonable for the MP to vote using their own conscience on that, along those lines. It was a free vote for Labour. So Jeremy Corbyn did not impose a whip. And what him and John McDonnell ended up doing was not imposing a whip, saying it was a free vote. Apparently, when they went into the shadow cabinet meeting where it's going to be decided whether or not it was a free vote, the Guardian were briefed by Jeremy Corbyn's advisers a few minutes in that it would be a free vote, but that official Labour Party policy would be anti-war, except it would seem that none of the MPs in that meeting had been briefed on that, and neither had Jeremy Corbyn. So various MPs' phones started going off 10 minutes in with these Guardian live feed updates, at which point apparently the meeting took what someone diplomatically described to me as a turn, yes. And various people said that they would not be leaving that room until there was no official party policy and it was a free vote. And 2 hours later, that was the outcome. We're in a position where Jeremy Corbyn was not strong enough, I think this is poor leadership, was not enough of a leader to basically say, look, I'm whipping this, either in the first place to reach a shadow cabinet consensus. There were little attempts made, from my knowledge, to actually try and persuade people round. One of the meetings, he turned up and read from a pre-prepared statement. So there was no real attempt to engage in the kinder, gentler politics of modern debate that we hear so much about. And that didn't really happen, from what I've heard anyway. So he then tried to impose a whip on the shadow cabinet, and did not have the strength in leadership to be able to do that. I mean, if he did want the Labour Party to vote against the war, what he should have done was just gone, look, I'm whipping this, and if you don't like it, go away and I'll build another shadow cabinet. And he obviously didn't feel strong enough to do that. And so there was a free vote. And then him and John McDonnell made these kind of sort of comments along the lines of, oh, well, you know, you need to think carefully and be aware of the consequences, which basically was I think it was Tim Shipman, one of the newspaper political correspondents, but was basically saying was, you can vote how you want, but, you know, momentum will come after you if you vote for war strikes. And my mind isn't made up at all on Syria. I think, on balance, having listened to the debate, I still don't think the case was made, because I don't think there's enough of a political consensus in Syria to replace what is happening with something else that is going to, you know, produce any more stability for the people of Syria. But having said that, I can understand it is very finely balanced. I can understand why people voted both ways. And there was also alleged that new MPs, the new intake, of which there were about 53, I think, were all taken into a meeting and were basically reminded of what effect it might have on their prospects if they were to vote for rather than against. So obviously this is completely different politics to New Labour. This is genuinely a new politics. We've never heard this before, have we, Honk? So no. there are a handful, including one of the whips. One of the whips is a new MP called Holly Lynch, who's up in Halifax, and I admire her actually, because she thought about it. She is a whip, and she voted for, which has probably put an end to her government career for the considerable future, I think. But I think if you're, you know, we criticise politicians. I think my main point is we criticise politicians for being, you know, sort of automons of the party machine. We criticise them for not being people. We criticise them for being disconnected from people. But that doesn't necessarily mean that members of a political party tell them what to do. I still think they represent constituents. And B, you know, if we then criticise them for making their own decisions, how is that a step forward? I find this whole thing very, very troubling. And shows up to me, from a Labour Party perspective, that a lot of people that are flooding in don't really seem to understand democracy and the idea that MPs represent their constituents. And I think that's really wrong.
It's arguable that it was easy for Conservative MPs because they didn't have a free vote. They were under a party to vote for the
And that wasn't a story. And I think that should have been a story, because I think that everyone should have had a free vote.
And as you say, Labour MPs were granted reluctantly, as you say, by Mr Corbyn, a free vote. But not only had to consider all the factors we mentioned, but also the potential abuse and threats that did indeed arrive in their email inboxes, social media, and in Stella Creese's case, literally arrived at her front door.
Well, they didn't in the end, it turns out. She has actually quashed that story. They went past the end of her road, but they didn't go past the front door, apparently, although they did threaten to, so...
Yeah, it's perilous for our future as a democracy. If we have the concept of the free vote, it's coming increasingly under threat on issues of conscience. Not only by agitators threatening to strive to deselect, you know, any MP who fails to be their lapdog, but also, you know, and you said there it wasn't reported, also by the increasing trend for party leaders to impose the whipping system so that MPs become, you know, no more than hounds following the pack. But I wonder whether, you know, the Labour Party had something of a triumph on Thursday, unexpected triumph in many ways, with the by-election in Oldham. I wonder if I was coming in as that new man in Oldham, you know, I think I'd feel a bit concerned after all of this, you know, the outcome of how he is expected to behave now. And if he doesn't do what the Corbynistas say, then, you know, he's going to be deselected next week.
Well, I mean, it is very troubling. Oldham was interesting, actually, in the expect. I mean, it was a sort of a triumph versus disaster of expectation management. Mm. In that the Labour Party really did manage expectations very, very well, and UKIP, their expectation management seems to be tell the world we're going to get the moon and then hope for the best. And I think what Oldham taught us a lot and not very much at the same time. What it taught us was that the Labour Party ground machine is still very, very good. The UKIP ground machine is appalling. UKIP having triumphed a lot in air wars. And I don't agree with UKIP, but I still think that the electoral system is wrong in that they could get so many millions of votes at the last election and only deliver and only return one MP. I don't agree with UKIP's politics, but I think that's bad for democracy. Having said this, Farage's non-resignation, un-resignation, I think really, really hurt them more than they could have ever imagined, because I think it had a huge impact on activist morale, such as they are, as a result of which UKIP did not really have much of a ground game. There is no getting away from the fact that, having spoken to several activists that went out on the doorsteps, Jeremy Corbyn was not popular. Jim McMahon was a hugely, hugely popular local candidate who had ridiculous name recognition, according to someone I spoke to, who was a big local figure in politics, the council leader, and had made an enormous impact. So I think much of it can be put down to him. It was still a safe seat for Labour. So, yes, we were told that Labour would be in real trouble there, but actually they weren't. They got a bigger share of the vote, but on a reduced turnout. So that's as broad as it is long, really, I think. You'd expect, you know, an opposition to hold a by-election, to hold a safe seat of their own during a by-election. Although Stephen Bush from the New Statesman has done various number crunchings and worked out increased share of voting percentages comparing Ed Miliband to Jeremy Corbyn. And there were 13 by-elections during Ed Miliband's reign, and such as it was, and 9 of them had a bigger percentage swing than this one did. And we are very, very, very early on in this parliament, and historic trends are for oppositions to go down in terms of percentage of the vote. And someone worked out, I think again it might have been Stephen K. Bush, worked out that if this opposition continues to erode at the same level of losing voters the last one did, for the 2020 election, Labour can expect about 22 to 23% of the vote, which you know, anyone would know is not good news at all. I mean, Labour held a safe seat. They held it fairly convincingly. But the argument against Corbyn, or rather the defeating of arguments from the Corbyn camp that, you know, oh, it's all going to, you know, it's going to be a new politics and a surge and a new movement. The arguments against that are that we always, those of us that did not agree with this, always said that the danger was, and this happened to some extent under Ed Miliband's Labour, was that Labour shored up its vote in places that were probably going to vote Labour anyway. So there was an increased turnout and increased voting in what were already ostensibly safe Labour seats. But in marginals and non-safe Labour seats, the vote decreased. And I can't, you know, that seems to fit with the same pattern. And the other thing, and I think Dan Hodges made this point, and I go on and off Dan Hodges at the Telegraph, but I do think this was a good point, was that he said that we were told by Corbyn and co when he came in that, you know, it was going to be this huge surge, that loads and loads and loads of non-voters from everywhere and young people that didn't vote and all that kind of stuff, they were all going to come herring out and vote for Corbyn. And that was going to be something that happened, and it was going to be this enormous surge. And actually, I know it was a by-election and it was raining, but you would hope that a new life-changing surge in politics would be able to overcome those factors. And, you know, turnout was 40%, which is pretty good for a by-election in those circs, but it wasn't enormous. If we were following the logic that there was going to be this enormous surge, then you would have expect Labour to have increased its share of the vote far more, and to have increased the votes that it got rather than losing them. So, Corbyn and McDonnell, according to reports in the papers today, Sunday, have you know, that's buoyed them up, and, you know, possibly preparing for a new year clear out of the cabinet and all of that kind of stuff. I do feel sorry for Jim McMahon, because I think that lots of that victory can be put down to him and Andrew Gwynn, the MP that run his campaign. And Jim McMahon is sort of, you know, I've read stuff by him before. He's to the right of the party. He writes for Progress. He's made in the National Press for various quite strong comments about benefits claimants. He sits to the right of the party as a and actually, interestingly, the left of the party go on about, oh, our candidates, and again, you know, feeding into this momentum thing, our candidates are so, you know, so divorced from you know, reality, and we need more working class candidates. And interestingly, the big working class figures of Labour the last few years that I can think of, so this chap, Jim McMahon, Caroline Flint, Alan Johnson, to a lesser extent, Emma Reynolds, they all come from really working class backgrounds, in some cases really poor backgrounds, and got scholarships to, in Caroline Flint's case, at least got scholarships to Oxbridge and whatever. And yet they come from the right of the party. And I wonder if there's something in that, really. So so I don't know. It's you know, Labour continues to be a mess, is once again our headline of this week, I think. And again, it was very upsetting, both by both sides of the Labour Party debate and by the press, that something as deadly, deadly serious as Syria became about the internal politics of the Labour Party, which it never, ever, ever should have done. And I think all sides in Labour can take some blame for that, as can the national press. And again, I think the fact that Cameron whipped that vote and didn't allow anybody a free vote should have been a story, and it wasn't.
We're back talking about Tyson Fury after this from Birmingham, Alabama. Here's St. Paul and the Broken Bones. This ain't the heartache that I thought I knew. This ain't the party that I thought we'd do. You got your limit. Ben Tanner of Alabama Shakes, and featuring the remarkable voice of Paul Janeway. That's St. Paul and the Broken Bones and Call Me. Juliet, last weekend I watched a boxing match that was so lacking in action, I described it as like watching a fight between the Dalai Lama and Mahatma Gandhi.
which is the big ticket event of the year, I understand.
Nevertheless, after 12 pedestrian rounds of prodding and clinching, a points decision brought the world heavyweight title to the United Kingdom's Tyson Fury.
Sounds emphatic, doesn't it, the way you're describing it?
Could there ever be a boxer more appropriately named from birth? Tyson Fury. So hooray and hurrah. Let's celebrate the triumph of our great champion. But, hold it right there, because it turns out that our hero, Tyson Fury, holds views that were deemed surplus to requirements several generations ago. I'm not going to give Fury's opinions the oxygen of publicity, but suffice to say, in an interview with The Mail's Oliver Holt, Fury sallied forth with his retro views on abortion, homosexuality and paedophilia, indeed linking the latter two together. Should we be organising an open-top bus parade for Tyson Fury, or should we be boycotting his next fight?
George? Well, I think the main point that we ought to talk about in this is the fact that he's been nominated for BBC's Sports Personality of the Year. Now, in the past, my father and I particularly have been anti-BBC Sports Personality of the Year because they keep being given, the award keeps being given to people that don't seem to have any personality at all. I use Michael Owen as the first exhibit in this instance, and to some extent Andy Murray in the second, although I do think he has improved. But so the BBC Sports Personality of the Year award. I haven't looked up an official definition, but for people that aren't aware of it, and I don't blame you, frankly, because it is pretty boring. It's on just before Christmas. It's televised on the BBC. It's a celebration of British sport for the entire year. There are various awards, including Team of the Year, Young Sports Personality of the Year, that sort of thing. And the climax is there are nominees for this BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and it's quite vague on what the remit is for that. Are you voting for someone who has achieved a huge amount in the sport they are, or are you voting for a personality? Are you voting for someone that you really, really like? Hence why, rather embarrassingly, a few years ago, Ryan Giggs won Sports Personality of the Year for not having necessarily done a great deal in terms of sporting terms, but I suspect having had a vote rigged by Manchester United fans who really, really wanted him to win. And to be fair, Ryan Giggs did have the good grace to look very embarrassed as he accepted that award. But so if you think about it in those terms, Tyson Fury has won the world championships as a boxer. It's come back to Britain. So yes, you'd say, yes, that is a big achievement for Sports Personality of the Year award. But in terms of sports personality, for me, that has some kind of role model implication attached as well. And this is my problem with this. Yes, you're not voting on someone's views. You're voting on their sports achievements. Fair enough. But when you are saying that someone is a Sports Personality of the Year, for me, you are sort of implying this is someone that we can hold up and admire. And, you know, this is an influence for young people, because I suspect the only people that are still interested in Sports Personality of the Year are families with young children or younger sports obsessed people. I know that I used to watch it religiously as a child that was not old enough to go out yet. And I think that's one of those things. And for me, I don't. The problem is that he doesn't just have views that I disagree with, as you put it. He has views, particularly with the homosexuality paedophilia thing, he has views which would have long been rejected many, many, many years ago. And to be holding that up as something that is aspirational is to me very troubling. I would prefer it if he wasn't on that list. I think if you're being a sports personality, it's not just the same as being a sportsman. You should be conducting yourself in ways that are acceptable in public life. And I think that the comments that he made have been so strong that they've gone, I think, beyond the pale of what is acceptable. I think they've gone beyond the sort of area of reasonable free speech, I think, and I think they are unacceptable. And so I have a bit of a problem with him still being included in this list, I must admit.
The admittedly increasingly irrelevant BBC Sports
Personality. Yes, true. I'm not claiming this is an enormous thing, but it's still a thing that's there. It still gets
still
viewers,
a thing.
It's still advertised.
So bearing in mind that Anthony Crolla, AP McCoy, Jamie Vardy and the current number one batsman in the world, Yorkshire's Joe Root, they're amongst those who are omitted from the shortlist of candidate for this Sports Personality of the Year award. And as we say, when it was publicised on Monday, there was the name of Tyson Fury cosily included. But as we were discussing a few minutes ago before St Paul and the Broken Bones, we're supposed to be living in a democracy. And so, therefore, I wouldn't say Fury shouldn't be included, but I can only hope that people are aware of the fellow's views before they register their vote. But what I found particularly telling about this, as a nation, and I think America is the same, we do tend to turn the other way when we find our heroes have got feet of clay. It's as if the skills to hit a ball or score a goal, it kind of boots issues such as domestic violence and other appalling deeds into the long grass.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And personally, I mean, I would say now that I'm aware of the kind of man Tyson Fury is, next time he steps into the ring, I won't be paying to view.
No, exactly. I mean, I very rarely watch boxing anyway, but yes, I'm inclined to agree. It is difficult, isn't it? I don't want to fall into this kind of let's ban everything type thing. But I agree with you. I'm not hugely comfortable with him being on that list, and I can only hope that you know people pick other things. And if I was Joe Root, I'd feel very, very aggrieved, because I think if anybody deserves a place on that list, particularly as someone who's performed well in a not very good team at times,
appears to be a thoroughly, one can only say what one sees, but appears to be a thoroughly decent young fellow with, you know, a time for everybody and, you know, a generally good character. So, if it's about personality, as we were saying, you know,
it's bewildering. Yes.
Absolutely bewildering. We've had Pulp from England, St. Paul and the Broken Bones from Alabama. Now let's head to, we'll go to Scandinavia now. From 2006, Norway's Lorraine and I Feel It. It scraped into the UK top 40 for 1 week in April 2006. I'm surprised it didn't rise further than that 1 week at number 29, the hooky and rather compelling single I Feel It from Norway's Lorraine.
I see, I wasn't familiar with that. And when I looked it up written on paper, I was expecting some sort of disco hit by a disco diva. It's just that I Feel It by Lorraine sounded like possibly a Eurovision entry. And actually, having heard that, there is a slight swing of a Eurovision entry to that, actually. And like you say, I'm surprised it wasn't a bigger hit, because it felt like it was sort of built to be a hit, really.
I love songs with big hooks, with big hooks. I'm addicted to them. I can never get enough. In the world of popular music, there are two different worlds out there right now. What the official chart returns and radio stations think people want to hear, and the real universe in which streaming statistics tell us what people actually are listening to. This week, Spotify released its 2015 Year in Music lists, and it generally makes fascinating reading. One of the key lessons is that in the traditional top 40, many artists blaze in, sell quickly, and just as speedily drop out of the charts and the radio playlists. But people streaming music at home or on their mobile devices continually return to favourites, creating that cliché phrase, a long tail for a song that doesn't exist in the short-term world of pop radio. So, for example, Coldplay, current example, release a single in the UK, it goes in quite high but doesn't climb the charts. Their diminishing fan base in the singles market, but they buy it, but it has no traction. Meanwhile, over on Spotify, Drake accrues 1.8 billion streams in 2015 from 46 million different listeners, yet the old order don't get it, Jules. The game has changed.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, the top 40 feels increasingly irrelevant now, it has to be said. Since they moved it from Sundays, I don't even know when it is now. Is it on Fridays now? I'm completely confused.
I think so, but like you, I'm equally unsure.
And
yes.
and it's weird, isn't it? It just feels to be completely irrelevant. And like you say, the people seem to consume music by streaming nowadays. And you sent me a link to an article on a website called The Verge, and this is most interesting point from this was that it shows how perhaps the albums market is becoming less and less relevant, as well as the singles market. Is it said that Rihanna is the most streamed female of 2015, and she's had just over 1 billion streams, and she hasn't even released a full length album since 2013. And the other artists that it says it's worth noting that two artists that might have knocked Rihanna off at the top spot, so Taylor Swift and Adele, are absent from Spotify. Swift, none of her music's on the service. Adele's past albums are on Spotify, but 25 is not. So to some extent, Spotify doesn't quite give the full picture, but equally it does show that the artists that haven't released albums this year, the three artists behind Rihanna on the list, Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj and Beyonce, have also not released full albums this year. So it's interesting, isn't it? I'm not sure it's quite the full pitch. When you've got somebody who is, as the website beautifully puts it, record clobbering as Adele in terms of selling albums all over the show, and they're not on there. That's not, you know, Hello's been enormous, hasn't it? I don't know if Hello's got to number one or not, but I think I've assumed that it has, just simply because I've heard it absolutely everywhere. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, streaming does seem like it is the way forward, but the fact that, you know, certain artists are not included on it, like Taylor Swift and Adele, who've managed to have, you know, Taylor Swift, I don't think not being on Spotify has held her back, put it that way. Taylor Swift has sold enormous amounts of records and had enormous amounts of coverage. So I'm not sure how relevant the top 40 is anymore. Lots of people consume music by streaming, but I don't think streaming is the be-all and end-all when certain artists are not included on Spotify and still manage to obtain huge amounts of success.
Yes, I think Adele and Taylor Swift dominate the mainstream media, but the top five artists with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of streams in 2015. If we just quickly look at the top five overall. Fifth, Kanye West. Fourth, Maroon 5. Third, The Weeknd. Second, Ed Sheeran. First, Drake. Again, I take the point that if you probably stopped 100 people in the street and said, you know, what is the most listened to music of 2015? I doubt whether that 100 people either in the UK or in Chicago or
New York,
you know,
or wherever,
wherever would have picked those things. The most streamed track globally, I found this quite interesting as well, because, you know, again, one might have said, well, you know, of course they're not there, but, you know, you'd think it would be Adele or Bieber. You'd think it might be Bieber or something, but Justin Bieber. But it was Lean On by Major Lazer, which was, you know, maybe felt like a Here Today, Gone Tomorrow dance track last summer, but, you know, it's clearly made a substantial impact around world. And I think it's that, as I said, I know it's such a cliche to say it, but that long tail business where it is proving that whilst you can have still your chart blazers that come hurtling into the Billboard Top 100 or the UK Top 40 or wherever, and you know, have like their 2 or 3 weeks in the sun, which I would include, you know, your X Factor winners in that. You know, oh, the biggest star in the world. Oh, next month, what was their name again?
Absolutely, but yes. Who?
There's one interesting side story to this, which I think is relevant in this week of all weeks when we're looking at mentioning Drake and Coldplay. We know in America the biggest sporting extravaganza, indeed the biggest television audience, is for the Super Bowl. And each year, the American football Super Bowl, each year a great deal of care is taken about the halftime entertainment. True. You know, that's like a show in its own right. And it is most curious that the act that they've chosen for this January is Coldplay, and yet when you know, you think, when I think about American football and those that follow it, and indeed the majority of those playing it now, it's they are not a Coldplay audience; they are a Drake audience, and yet the media in America think, let's go safe. Let's go, you know, Coldplay. And if it hadn't been Coldplay, it would have been, you know, U2 or some other, frankly, all-white group of clean-cut young men.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that shows a disconnect as well, I think, to some extent, doesn't it?
Just threw that in as a side issue. You can contact us if you wish to, or at least just keep up with what we're up to. The best way is on Twitter, SuperJules84.
Yes, that is me.
Juliet, and Sir Terence for me. And Jules, as I often ask you at this point, you'll be on the radio this week, I think, on Wednesday.
And on Saturday as well this week, yes. So Wednesday, the whatever it is, the 9th, I think, yes, I'll be doing Indie Wonderland, 8 till 10, all the usual cheery tunes and chat. And then on the Saturday after that, Saturday the 12th, it is the Christmas special of the Saturday Social this week. Yeah, so lots of Christmassy-themed Northern Soul, Motown, mod tunes, etc. So that will be something to look forward to, and then that's repeated on Boxing Day as well. So that's there will be an Indie Wonderland Christmas special, but we will talk about this in later weeks. So that's what's going on. And for me this week, Saturday Social, by the way, we might well end up having another podcast for that anyway, but the Saturday Social is 6 till 7 in the evening. I'm very loud about it on social media as well, so if you do have the misfortune indeed to collide with me on there, you will probably hear about it too.
Okay, we'll see you next week. Many thanks to Rona for her help this week. I hadn't heard of our closing track this week, Jules.
No, well, I hadn't either until very recently. And to fit in with our globetrotting this week, we end having gone to England, and then where was St. Paul and the Broken Bones from again?
Birmingham, Alabama.
Having gone to England, and then to America, and then to Norway. We now go back over the Atlantic to Canada, to Montreal. I was very fortunate that I was asked to DJ between songs at a gig earlier this week at the Hope and Ruin in Brighton that was put on by Melting Vinyl and the fabulously named Dictionary Pudding, which is a great promoter name, I think. DJing before and between two bands. One was a band called Chorus Girl, who half the members are originally from Germany, but they're based in London. And the headliners were these lot, who were called Moss Lime, who were three girls from Montreal who looked very young. They were very interesting, I thought. Both bands were great. They were very interesting to watch. I really liked the post-punk stylings of this. It's from their... They've got a new album out shortly, but this... I think it might be out now, actually. But this is from their first EP, and it's called Calabria 2014. Easy now, no need to figure down, just work.
You have been listening to a DAKM Media production.